I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The writer Tom Rice joins me now. He's got a new book out, The Black Count, Glory, Revolution, Betrayal, and the Real Count of Monte Cristo. It tells a story of Alex Dumas, the father of Alexander Dumas, the writer of The Three Musketeers and The Count of Monte Cristo. Alex Dumas, the father, was born in Haiti to a French nobleman and a black slave. In his own time, he was famous as a dashing swordsman, a military commander, and a hero of the French Revolution. However, his rival, Napoleon Bonaparte, sought his erasure from French history. He dies when Alexander is but four, yet the impact on his young son's life is clear as he inspires heroes in his son's later works. It's a really fascinating story, and I'll get Mr. Rice to tell us about how he came upon Dumas the father, what he learned, why we should read about him, as well as discuss race and what part that played in the Dumas story. The website for more is at tomrice.com. Previous books by Tom Rice include Führer X and The Orientalist, which was an international bestseller and a critical hit. This new book is published by Crown. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Tom Rice. Mr. Rice, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Nice to be on.
Thanks for joining us. So, Alex Dumas, the father. I guess in France, they differentiate between the two. Alexander Dumas, fille, which is a son, and then père, which is father, right?
Yeah, I mean, you've got Dumas the father is the great novelist, author of The Three Musketeers and The Count of Monte Cristo. Dumas fils, Dumas the son, is this Victorian playwright.
Yeah.
But, in fact, nobody knows about the real Dumas père, or the real Dumas the father, or basically, you could call him the grandfather, who is my character, the general.
I see. So let's talk about the grandfather, the character of the Black Count, the I guess the protagonist of this book. He was born in Haiti, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Now, he was half-black. The mother was a slave, and then the father was a French nobleman who had been in Haiti, right?
Right. The father was this sort of, I mean, it's a very strange, it's a story straight out of Alexander Dumas, even starting with his father, who was this renegade nobleman, this rogue who'd gone to Haiti to make his fortune. He had actually gone there to sponge off his younger brother, who was a huge sugar planter and plantation owner. The brothers got into a fight, and the older brother, the father of my hero, Alex Dumas, ran off into the forest, taking three of the younger brother's slaves, and he went into the forest, and he was not heard from again for nearly 30 years, and half the police force of the colony of Haiti went out looking for him, and they just could not find him. And it was part of the background to the story. I dug up even detective records that had been sort of the detectives they'd sent out in the middle of the 18th century looking for this guy, partly because they had to figure out who was going to inherit the ancestral castles in France, and eventually they had to declare him presumed dead because nobody had seen him so long. So you start off with this mysterious guy who's presumed dead, and really the story begins when he decides to rematerialize in the year 1776 and goes to France, and lo and behold, he happens to have a black son that he doesn't bring with him when he first shows up in France. In fact, he's such a scoundrel that he actually pawns his own son as a slave because he's black and it's the colony. He pawns him for the money to buy a ship ticket, but when he goes back to France and he inherits a castle and a title, he sends for the boy, and young Alexander Dumas, or he's not called that yet, he's actually listed as the slave Alexander when he arrives in France on the ship's manifest. He first puts his boots on French soil in the year 1776.
Yeah. Now, this character that you write about in the book is not well known. So how did you come across him? When did you initially come across him?
Well, I came across him actually in the works of his son, of Alexander Dumas. The incredible thing was that, like a lot of kids, I was a huge Alexander Dumas fan, both from the movies and also from the books. I mean, I think I probably, you know, had seen every version of the Three Musketeers by the time I was 10, and then I'd read the books and The Count and all of the other Dumas books, and I was so into the character, also for personal reasons. My mom is from France, and the sort of family lore is the only book she had when she came to the United States with her was The Count of Monte Cristo. And so, anyway, the thing loomed large. I loved the novelist Alexander Dumas, And when I was still a kid, I actually dug up his memoirs. And these memoirs had last been published in English in the 19th century. Nobody reads them, but if you read them, the amazing thing about them is that the first 200 pages are all about another man, even though it's supposed to be an autobiography. They're not about the writer, Alexandre Dumas. They're about his father. They're about this man called General Dumas, who became a general, who, when you read about him, you feel like, wait, I'm reading about D'Artagnan, Porthos, Aramis, and Edmond Dantès, but actually it's supposedly a real person. So I was very, very intrigued, both as a lover of these adventure books and also as a lover of history, that somebody like this could have existed. And I kind of carried this intrigue with me for many years until I decided to really hunt down his the truth of his story.
So the first 200 pages of that memoir, I guess that's the starting point in terms of your research, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. It's not even research. I mean, it was that was the starting point in terms of that's what I knew about this man for so long. And the reason that the writer, Alexandre Dumas, knew about him, because his father died when he was very young, was that his father had been the great hero of the French Revolution, who had been sort of crushed and kind of written out of history by Napoleon Bonaparte when Napoleon kind of took over France. One of the people he wanted out of the scene was Alex Dumas, the novelist's father.
Yeah.
And so the novelist grew up with the idea, with this sort of idea that his father had been written out of French history unjustly, and he'd heard all the stories, though, from his father's former comrades in the army and from literally people across Europe who had encountered his father, who was just, in some ways, the most incredible man they'd ever known. We haven't even mentioned the fact that he was this great leader and figure in Europe in the 18th century, but he's black, you know,
yeah.
And this fact was not lost on all the Europeans who came to know him and then wrote to the family after he died, because, you know, for all kinds of reasons, he was the most remarkable person that many people had met. And so they told the son about his father, and the son determined that he would just do everything he could to bring his father's memory back, but he was a fiction writer, so he brought his father's memory back really by putting him and his exploits into the characters that people came to know as D'Artagnan and the Count of Monte Cristo and other Dumas characters. But he really was not a biographer or nonfiction writer, so the memoir is, you know, it's a sort of an attempt at biography, but what is really moving about the memoir where he writes about his father is just the incredible, the love that shines through in the memoir, and it's not sort of like sappy love. I mean, it's
yeah.
He really sees his father from all these different perspectives as a kind of unique inspiration for himself and for other people.
So when he's writing his father into some of these characters in his books, I mean, that's, I guess, part of the rehabilitation, part of the sort of avenging of his dad's legacy, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's how I look at it. I mean, when he puts his dad's sword fights into the beginning of The Three Musketeers, you know, we don't know, but we can only assume that for the novelist Alexandre Dumas, this was just some kind of great feeling of if not exactly, yeah, a kind of revenge, a kind of beautiful revenge.
What, because we were talking of a person that's, you know, hundreds of years away from us.
200 years.
Yeah. How do you get material? How do you do your research in terms of finding out about this guy? Because, as you said earlier, that he'd been erased from French history, right?
Yeah, in fact, the research for this book was really something. It was something out of an Alexandre Dumas novel, in fact. Of course, I went around to all the, you know, France has incredible archives. The French really, really protect their history. And because Alex Dumas had been a great war hero in the 1790s, and those records still exist, I was able to find all the, you know, army records of the incredible sort of exploits and things that he'd done, because he was a kind of action hero of the Revolution, if you will. He was a sort of Sergeant York, or he was almost like a Rambo figure some of the time, but he was definitely more of a special forces kind of guy, the guy who, when he had to take a peak in the Alps, in the middle of a glacier, he actually put on the the ice boots. He put on cleats on his boots and climbed the ice cliffs himself, leading 2,000 men behind him. But he always sort of led out in front of him. So you read incredible things about him in the archives of the military, but none of this is the personal stuff that I needed to get at. And I got that by going to the town where he died in France. It's this little place about 75 miles from Paris. Kind of a gray town. There's not much there. But I found a woman who had been kind of collecting documents about him. And she had this office in the town in this small little museum there. And I arranged to corresponded with her, arranged to come and meet her. And the problem was I kind of dawdled and procrastinated. This was in 2006. And I waited. I thought, nobody's been at this for 200 years. It's okay if I take my time.
Right.
But I arrived there in January 2007 to the news that the woman had just died 2 weeks before I got there.
Wow.
Quite suddenly. She wasn't old or anything, and she was not sick as far as I knew. But without going into the circumstances behind that, the remarkable and horrible thing for me was she had put everything she had of value, including all the documents I'd talked to her about, into a big safe.
Yeah.
A locked safe. And she hadn't told anyone the combination. So when I arrived, the people in the town told me, basically, this is a hopeless situation. You've got a dead woman and a locked safe, and none of us know the combination, and the safe is on government property, and we can't just, there's only so much we can do. If we can't open it, and if we've searched everywhere, you know, we'll just go through channels. And I knew then that I had to find a way to blow open the safe inside a government building. So that was a kind of a fun yet nerve-wracking way to begin the research. But I eventually succeeded, and when I got inside the safe with a lot of people's help, what I found in there, among many amazing personal letters and things, was the document that Alex Dumas had written right after his two-year imprisonment in a dungeon in Italy. And it's this document that was the basis for the beginning of The Count of Monte Cristo, and it's written in General Dumas' own hand. So there's something for a biographer. I mean, there could be nothing more sort of moving than finding that. And it was really the center.
Exactly.
Once I had that, I knew I had my story.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier that we haven't even mentioned the fact that he's black. I guess at the time, slavery was happening, right, in the United States, and then France as well, right?
It was happening all over the world. The whole world economy operated on slavery. And in fact, at this time, France's economy was much more dependent on slavery than the United States. And the French ran the world sugar trade, and the most powerful colonies for France in the 18th century were the sugar islands in the Caribbean. In fact, the French pretty willingly gave up all of Canada rather than let the British take a couple more sugar islands in the West Indies, because these sugar islands were just the most valuable pieces of real estate on earth. Sugar was kind of the oil of the 18th century for various reasons, and Haiti, the place that became Haiti, this French colony, was really the Saudi Arabia of the sugar business. And so, you know, sugar was an incredibly slave-intensive industry, so that's why all of this begins and ends with the sort of slaves and sugar at the beginning of Alex's life. In fact, his uncle, who I referred to before, the successful planter, ran slaves and sugar out of a little piece of land in the north of Haiti that's still there, and it's called Monte Cristo. So, you know, the origins of that name.
So how was he perceived then? I mean, he was black. I mean, it wasn't like he was fair-skinned or anything.
No, he couldn't pass. He was quite dark-skinned.
Yeah, so how is he viewed then as someone who, I mean, he becomes quite big in the military, right?
Yeah, I mean, there are just so many fascinating angles to this that I discovered as I was researching, because that's, of course, the big question facing you when you look at this. How could how could France's great war hero have been a black man, just who had grown up at the height of slavery? And you know, he also, before he became this great war hero, he became the second or third greatest swordsman in France. And what I discovered was his teacher in Paris was another black man, another guy whose mother had been a slave, and this guy was the undisputed fencing champion of Europe. And when the revolution broke out, these two black swordsmen, half aristocratic, half black swordsmen, formed a group of revolutionaries that they called the Free Legion of Americans, but it was nicknamed the Black Legion because everyone in it were these black riders. And I mean, all of this only could take place because there was this incredible civil rights movement that happened in France in the middle of the 18th century that has really also been just as forgotten or kind of wiped out of history as Alex Dumas' incredible career. And this was a civil rights movement that was taking place at the very heart of the world's most lucrative and cruel slave empire. And so there's a lot of paradox connected to it. But in some ways, what the French saw themselves as doing was fulfilling the promise of the American Revolution that had never been fulfilled, because obviously the Americans, you know, we had our revolution in 1776, and we introduced the Declaration of Independence that was supposed to apply for everybody, to everybody, but it obviously didn't apply to anybody whose skin was black. And especially over the decade immediately after the American Revolution, which was just leading up to the French revolutionaries were intensely aware of this. I found through all of these documents that people just have not looked at enough that, you know, from Robespierre on down, they all knew that the issue of black people and how liberty, equality, and fraternity, the slogan of the French Revolution, mm-hmm. how it was going to apply across racial boundaries or not, was one of the great issues of the day. And for a while, for a very brief, wonderful time, they settled it in the way that modern people would think was right, and they sort of unilaterally broke down all of the barriers and gave a man like Alex Dumas the chance to rise as high as he possibly could on his own merits, and his merits turned out to be pretty incredible.
Now, Napoleon and him did work together, I guess, and Napoleon took him to Egypt, is that right?
Yeah, he went to Egypt as Napoleon's cavalry commander.
Yeah, and then what happened there? They fell out?
They fell out. They had already started to fall out when they were campaigning together in Italy, when Napoleon had to grudgingly acknowledge Dumas as this sort of action hero of the Italian campaign. He actually called him compared him to the Roman heroes and said that he had sort of saved the French army the way the Roman heroes had by holding back the German barbarians. But even though he was saying things like that, Napoleon never liked Dumas from the beginning, because Dumas' sort of fatal characteristic was that he couldn't keep his mouth shut when he had something to say. He had to speak his mind. He was a tough guy, and he was a man who didn't mince words. And when he saw that Napoleon was doing things that he thought were betraying the revolution, he said so. And he did that especially when they went to Egypt together, which was really, you know, a time when Napoleon was betraying the French Revolution. It was right before he was about to impose his dictatorship on France, and he sort of imposed a dictatorship on Egypt as a kind of trial run for that first. And Dumas and Napoleon clashed in the desert. Dumas confronted Napoleon about, what are we doing here? You know, you're trying to establish an empire in the desert. We're losing thousands of men. This is not what the revolutionary armies are supposed to be for. We're supposed to be there to liberate people from condition of bondage. That was how they saw it. And anyway, the other reason I think that they clashed in the desert, I found the records of Napoleon's doctor, his physician in Egypt, described what the Egyptians thought when they first saw the French troops, this huge French force coming over the dunes towards the city of Alexandria, and they saw at the head of it this, as he described it, this magnificent tall man of color who sat on his horse so naturally that he looked like a centaur. And behind him they saw this scrawny little guy, you know, because at the time we think of Napoleon as sort of, the pejorative tends to be that he's short, but nobody accused him of being short at the time. The problem with him was that he was very kind of scrawny and skinny, and the Egyptians were sure when they saw these two men that the tall black man on the horse was the leader, and Napoleon was sort of falling behind him. when I found that from the physician, I mean, it's just kind of an interesting detail, but I think that must have played a lot into the personal dislike. Mm. And the dislike is, you know, you see it in any time Napoleon mentioned Dumas up until his death, even in his exile on St. Helena. He had a very bad memory of the 6'2" blustery fellow who he didn't think deserved a place in the ranks of his followers, mainly because he just wasn't a good enough follower of Napoleon. Napoleon didn't tolerate people who thought for themselves.
Yeah.
Or rather, who they could think for themselves as long as they thought Napoleon was God, but if they didn't, then it was a problem.
Yeah. I'm curious to know what relationship you have with the people that you write about. In this case, in terms of Alex Dumas, do you have to like them? Because you are with them for a long time, aren't you?
That's an interesting thing, interesting question. I think that with Alex Dumas it was easy because he is such an admirable and, you know, captivating man on so many levels. And it really, you know, you don't have to work to like him. And his flaw, which is, as I said, an excess of candor and kind of backtalk, is a kind of charming flaw. So yeah, I didn't have a problem with this project. The last book that I worked on, The Orientalist, featured a much less likable character as the main character. But I think in some ways I have to always identify with what drives my main character. I sort of like to one of the first things I want to understand, because I write about people who tend to be ideologically motivated. They're not just kind of out for profit or just for a career. I tend to be drawn to people who have ideals that they're pursuing one way or another. I have to be able to really get inside those ideals and understand what motivated them. And my last character, this guy Lev Nussbaum, mm-hmm. who grew up during the Russian Revolution, he was an anti-revolutionary, and what really motivated him was that he hated revolution and was scared of it. And by contrast, what really motivated Alex Dumas was that he grew up during the period of the American Revolution and then into the French Revolution, and for him, revolution was, you know, a beautiful thing. It was especially from his own perspective, it was the only way that black people could have a chance at that time, was some kind of universal revolution. That's the other thing. He was a universalist. He was no kind of racial separatist, so he definitely did not, he would have been very against the idea of Haiti breaking off and things like that, although, of course, he also witnessed the tragedy that Napoleon, you know, and the French, they attacked his homeland. They attacked Haiti to reimpose slavery. So Dumas just saw the triumph and tragedy of everything he believed in his own life. I mean, he lived fast. I tend to pick characters who live pretty fast and furious lives, and so by the time he was 40, he had risen to the top, and he'd seen everything he believed in kind of victorious, and then he saw all of it kind of go bad quick.
Yeah. This has been a fascinating conversation, Tom. I appreciate your time today. I can't wait to finish the book. Congratulations on it. It's already a bestseller, so you don't need good luck, but good luck nonetheless.
Oh, hey, I really appreciate it. It's been fun talking with you.
The website for more, tomrice.com. The book is called The Black Count, Glory, Revolution, Betrayal, and the Real Count of Monte Cristo. It's published by Crown. It's author Tom Rice on the line from New York and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.